So, Professor Harvey, you've written and spoke a lot about how the logic of human rights has been embedded with the logic of privatization and private property, and you suggested to think about rather human rights, to think about rights in a city. Just a general question, can you expand on that idea and also the role that urbanization in the city has in sort of formulating additional rights, and then also for areas that are not urbanized?
Yeah, just on the second, I mean, one of the insights that comes from Lefebvre is that the distinction between country and city is disappearing, and that really it's being absorbed into what you might call a general structure of uneven geographical development of capitalism. And so therefore, in many ways, I would want to talk about the rights associated or derived from or embedded in the processes of uneven geographical development, but that's such a big set of words. And the great thing about the city is it evokes something about citizenship and belonging, and so in many ways it's just a better term, tactical term, than it is a technical term about where this is all going to go on. The UN Declaration of Human Rights was a very contested document at the time. And it's interesting that the American Anthropological Association objected to it on the grounds that it did not acknowledge collectivities, collective rights, cultural rights. And of course, ever since 1948, there's been this whole series of extensions in which modifications of the UN Declaration has been come out to try to deal with some of these kinds of questions of the rights of minorities or rights of cultural, religious rights, and so on. So there have been a lot of modifications of the original UN doctrine. Having said that, if only the UN Declaration had been implemented. Because even in the UN Declaration it says that people have a right to live in a decent living environment. It says that workers have a right to associate and have a right to a decent, it doesn't say living wage, but decent standard of living. In other words, there's a whole series of things around, items 18 to 22 of the UN Declaration. And if those had been rigorously enforced, we would be living in a very different world now than the one we are currently living in. So the UN Declaration did have some aspects in it that were about workers' rights. But again, it was very much about individual rights. Now, Marx has, I think, a very interesting kind of view of rights. He kind of says, well, basically the notion of rights is embedded in bourgeois culture. It is so tightly associated with private property and all the rest of it that you can't really have one without the other. And in the chapter on the working day, he sets up this really interesting kind of thing where he kind of says, the capitalist says, I am right, I have my right, once I buy your labor power, to work you to death. Because your labor power belongs to me during the time of the contract, and I can do what I like with that. You have a commodity, it belongs to me, and I'm going to use it. And the worker says, you don't have a right to do that, I'm a living human being. And Marx kind of says, these two rights are equal. There's no way in which you can go up into the sky and kind of arbitrate between these two. And he says, between two equal rights, force decides. Michael Bloomberg has, in some ways, the right to New York City. And he could claim that right, and does, and acts upon it. Groups in New York City, like Picture the Homeless, and allies will kind of say, well, actually, we have that right, and we're going to contest you. So rights are always contested. So it's not as if there's some absolute standard to which you can appeal. It's always about contestation. And it's always about fighting out for my rights, And as Marx points out, the working day, the workers fight for limitations on the working day, and capitalists resist. And so, you know, so the whole field of rights is not an abstract philosophical issue that can be solved by philosophical kind of arbitration or debate. It is about the rights that particular groups wish to claim. And that means that the right to the city is a contested right. It's contested at many different levels. And therefore, there's again the question of alliances between different groups as they seek to say, well, who is the major enemy here? Is our enemy this minority population that is coming into our neighborhood and diminishing property values? Is our enemy the homeless people who are on the street who, you know, as a good bourgeois citizen, I find offensive to actually have them around. And therefore, when we collect around the right, we have to first think about the collectivity that articulates the right. And collectivity in this case, it starts with picture the homeless and the anti-gentrification group and CAV and all of the others, and kind of says, well, you know, we have a notion of right to the city and we are going to try and make our right prevail. And we know we're in a struggle over that. And it's not a philosophical issue, it's a political issue. And therefore, that's the way in which I think one should think about rights and always be careful about the distinction between individual rights and collective rights. Even the American Anthropological Association objected to the UN Declaration on the grounds it didn't handle collective rights sufficiently well. And I think that that was a correct objection even at that time. And now I think it's even more strongly so.
Hi, my name is Sonai. I want to re-mention the concept that you mentioned, the eco-Marxism, and maybe we have to add eco-anarchism to that concept. And now we have a new concept emerging, which I want to mention, like eco-capitalism. And I really wonder what you think about this new hot topic on sustainability and those eco-concepts from a Marxist view of point. And do you think that it could be a new plan to save capitalism, kind of a Keynesian stuff?
The environment as big business has been around for quite a while now, since if you look at environmental technologies, for example, they got listed on the stock exchange as a separate sector somewhere around 1992 or something like that. So environmental questions have been incorporated in big business and corporate dynamics for some considerable time now. We're now in a situation where, yes, there's a economic difficulty crisis on, and in particular places, for particular reasons. The United States is a bit concerned about its dependency on oil and its vulnerability on oil, and therefore is beginning to sort of push on some of these other alternative technologies, and yes, it will be partly done through deficit financing and Keynesian kind of politics. I actually think that is relatively small in terms of actually creating a new dynamic for capitalist development. In other words, I don't see the greening of technology, you know, I don't see the greening of everything as being the savior of capitalism right now, not at all. And if anything, of course, what Al Gore gave us at Kyoto was the idea that actually global warming has to be handled through the market, that therefore carbon trading is the way to go. That is another speculative market which is being created. It's you can start to buy carbon futures and all the rest of it, so actually you're creating another sort of market which can absorb surplus capital in a speculative kind of way, and actually to some degree the European market is already doing that. It's already a big market, and I think that one of the things that will come out of Copenhagen is making that really global. If anything comes out of Copenhagen, it will be that. So I don't see the sort of a version of eco-capitalism, like I said, has been around for some considerable time, and I don't see it doing that much. And there are all sorts of constraints on it, which most people don't realize. And then if you really go for say wind power and things like that, you really need a lot of what are called rare earth metals, and which have high conductivity. If you use usual magnet stuff, you lose a lot of the energy that comes from it. You really need the rare earth metals to do it. And unfortunately, 95% of the global trade in rare earth metals is controlled by China. The resources of rare earth metals are very rare. That's what they're called, rare earth metals, you know. So there are actually, it's interesting, there are strong environmental constraints, and it also turns out one of the reasons the Chinese have such a domination in this market is because the environmental conditions of extracting the rare earth metals are absolutely appalling, and only the Chinese can not bother about that kind of thing. Almost anywhere else you'd be in real trouble. There are too many constraints facing that. If you want my nomination for the way in which capitalism is likely to evolve technologically around the economic kind of question, it's going to be in things like biomedical engineering, genetic engineering, and all those kinds of things for a variety of reasons. One of them, again, comes back to the rentier economy, intellectual property rights. I mean, the reason that the United States is so concerned about World Trade Organization and the intellectual property rights clause of that is because if you can extract rents for actually genetically defined, copyright DNA sequences and things like that, patent them, then actually this is one of the big futures. But again, a lot of that is going to be speculative, and a lot of it's going to be rentier. And at the same time, and one of the clues to this, by the way, is if you look very carefully at what the major foundations are funding, Gates Foundation, the Soros Foundation, how much of it is going into biomedical engineering? A huge amount of it. And of course, this is all seen as being great. I mean, don't we all want to live to 100? Isn't this great? They're going to deal with global diseases, we're going to deal with all of that, The fact that people starve to death is irrelevant, but at least you've solved the problem of malaria or, those kinds of things. So all of those foundations, and Michael Bloomberg gives, $50 million to Johns Hopkins University to do stem cell research. I mean, this is the kind of big thing that seems to me to be looming as, if you like, one of the technological. If there's going to be a new speculative wave, it's almost certainly going to be based not on green technologies, but on biomedical engineering and all the genetic engineering kind of technologies.
You've talked a bit about post-capitalist ways of behaving, but I guess I'm searching more for specifics about what that really looks like on the ground. If that's about community coalitions working with the government to try to enforce more controls over banks, over institutions, or if this is about community organizations coming together and supporting each other to work against a system that already exists, and just what you envision as like the practicality of this movement.
I think the interesting thrust of the discussions this week was the way in which social movements are actually grappling with that question and coming up with answers to that question. I mean, I you know, I don't feel it's my job to kind of tell anybody what they should be doing. In fact, the solutions you're talking about are some social movements will articulate the first, and some will articulate the second. So I don't have any kind of judgmental thing, kind of saying, well, this one's right or that one's wrong, or you should got to go this way, you've got to go that way, because there are situations in which clearly collaboration with the state can actually win you something. And getting legislation through the state. And actually, you find most social movements do a bit of both. I mean, for instance, Picture the Homeless is pursuing legislation in city council and trying to get that legislation through. So they are, you know, if not exactly collaborating, but they're putting pressure on the state apparatus and the political process to come up with certain things. At the same time, as they're also trying to build, you know, new social relations. So most places, you know, most social movements do both. So my view of that is that actually, you know, the social movements are in a better position to answer that kind of question than I am. I'm not an organizer on the ground. You know, I find it hard to organize my own life, let alone organize other people. You know, I'm the last person you should ask about that. And I think that one of the, you know, this does have a sort of question as to what the relationship should be between people like myself who, you know, kind of write and think in academia and all the rest of it, and what the social movements. I mean, my view of it is that social movements know their own situation far better than I do. They're much better in terms of defining their own tactics. If, on the other hand, people within the social movement want to think a bit more about the context in which they're doing their work and how to figure where they are in that context, then, you know, we could talk and I can help sort of define that. And it's not, again, not to say I'm right about it, but the if I can help in that way, I would want to do it. So my feeling is I wouldn't want to be trying to advise on tactics and specifics on the ground. The specifics on the ground emerge out of, you know, take back the land. I think it's great what they're doing. And I think that it's great what Picture the Homeless is doing, or what CAB is doing, and so on. So I think, you know, so I don't have a general kind of answer to that question, and I don't think it would be even appropriate for me to try. I mean, you can say that's a cop-out, if you like, which it sort of is, but...
In the 1970s, or since the 1970s, architects have largely retreated from what had been a mission to change society through design. And the theorist Manfredo Tafuri, for example, actually argued that you couldn't build anything within capitalism if you wanted to change capitalism. And that, of course, gave rise to an era of formalism in which it was more architecture for architecture's sake, which started out as a kind of political stance, but where it's gotten us today is more of a politics is kind of absent from Mr. Architecture. And your involvement in this jury in Korea, I think, is interesting, even though if it didn't bear fruit, as maybe you hoped, but it shows that maybe, I was hoping you could elaborate on whether you think that there is opportunity in these kind of large-scale planning projects and major design projects for collaboration between kind of critical theory and designers. It's certainly a problem that architects face is, you know, the requirement to produce something for a client which may have some requirements, and the will to produce something for society on the other. So I was wondering if you could speak any more to how that worked, either in that specific project or any others that you may be familiar with.
Yeah, you know, obviously, again, it comes back to the silver bullet kind of idea that there was a time when people thought that they were engaged in what you might call spatial determinism, that by, you know, reorganizing the space, you could change society or something like that. Obviously that was wrong, so Tafuri was right, but on the other hand, I think he was wrong. to kind of say that actually the reorganization of space relations has nothing whatsoever to do with revolutionary transformations. I think the reorganization of space relations is actually very important as part and parcel of a radical transformation. And it's important for all sorts of reasons. For example, when I was writing about the right to the city, it became even more apparent to me than ever that things like the suburbanization of the United States have had a huge impact upon political subjectivity. I mean, the mental conceptions of the world that go with living in a suburb. I mean, even if you object to living in a suburb, it also kind of says you're, you know, as many feminists did in, say, the 1960s or 1970s, or white youth did back in the 1960s. If you object to living in the suburbs, you're rejecting a certain kind of daily life. Figure what mode of consumption is involved in suburban way of life. Think of the political attitudes that are involved. And I think it's no accident that US politics has changed dramatically as a consequence of suburbanization post 1945. And actually, one of the biggest problems we have right now, it would seem to me, is you have this suburbanization, which was an answer to the Great Depression. That is, a vast amount of surplus capacity, which was not used in the Great Depression, which was much augmented in World War II through the world effort, the war effort, gets absorbed through the reconstruction of the urban landscape. I mean, how much capital did it take to build all the suburban houses and the highways and all the things that go with it? And again, Adam Smith talks about the way in which, you know, humankind has an infinite appetite for trinkets and baubles, but I don't understand why they would have an infinite appetite for lawnmowers. But when the suburbanization comes along, everybody has to have a lawnmower, you know, so there's a huge business. I mean, so all of this is going on. And right now you have probably, I don't know, the latest surveys I've seen suggest that still most people who live in the suburbs like their suburban way of life. And they don't want to change it. Now look at that suburban way of life and look at its energy absorption, which is huge, and its energy dependency, which is huge. I mean, people say the energy problem is a technological problem. It's not. It's a way of life problem. And in fact, it's a spatial design problem. And so some of the discussion that is beginning to go on about the reurbanization of the United States as being actually essential, even from the standpoint of capitalist development. And one of my big objections to the way in which the stimulus package has been devised, it's not been embedded in the idea of a major project. I mean, there was a major idea of doing this in 1945, which is suburbanize. What we should be having now, if capitalism wanted to survive, would be a reurbanization of the United States around a different kind of energy complex. But that means people have to change their way of life and their mental conceptions and blah, blah, blah. And they're not going to necessarily do it. So to me, the whole kind of spatial aspect and the spatial design aspect becomes rather critical. And there's no reason whatsoever why architects and planners can't start articulating this big time and say to people, you want to solve the environmental problem, you can only do it this way. I mean, you know, putting a few wind generators here, you know, isn't going to do it. But actually you need something which is a much more radical solution. It seems to me the architects and the designers and so on are in a position to be able to say something about it, as I felt was possible in this South Korean city situation, in which it would be possible to define a kind of new energy regime, a new waste disposal, even recycling internal to the city. And it was very interesting. It's a big floodplain there. And one of the proposals was that you should let it flood every now and again as a bit of urban spectacle. which actually seemed to be a rather nice idea. You know, let the river run free, and so the city would be built around the rim, and every now and again the river would flood, and they'd have this big, but then you could use the floodplain for all sorts of things like, you know, agriculture and so on, because of the temporality of the flood regime and all the rest of it. So you could actually, and actually you could recycle. Imagine how much you could recycle within the city and actually fertilize the floodplain and have intensive urban agriculture or something, you know. There are all kinds of ways in which we could start to think about this. So there's no reason why urban planners and architects and designers shouldn't have something very, very important to say about this. But in order to do that, I think you have to get away from this kind of art for art's sake and architecture for architecture's sake, and you have to actually start to think about the social and political role of design in these transformations. Because, as I'm arguing, there's a geographical dimension to, you know, the sort of co-revolutionary movement I'm talking about. In many ways, the bourgeoisie reconfigured the geography of the world according to its own values, according to its own standards, according to its own necessities. And that would have to be also part of what a socialist project should be about. So again, there is, if you like, a real area here. But again, the problem is when you start to say there's a silver bullet and then therefore we change the space and everything changes. Well, it doesn't. But nevertheless, the spatial transformation is part and parcel of any kind of co-revolutionary process, and therefore it's fundamental within the complex that I'm talking about.
Got it.
I was wondering how much value you think this idea, which is to say that observing that capitalism has this ability to swallow everything and make a good out of it, even things which are supposed to be against it. First, and that actually allows capitalism to exist in so-called democracies. So observing that, but noticing as well that to be swallowed, capitalism needs a little time to adapt somehow. Instead of talking about revolution and total flip of the system, what if we would set up ourselves into this little time, into those little sparks, into its little evanescence, to really exist and to disappear and to re-exist. And so you quote Lefebvre a lot, and he has this theory of moment, which is very interesting as well. And I'm also thinking that a lot of people recognize in the Paris Commune in 1871, the only real socialism existence. And I was wondering whether it was. I was also wondering whether it was because it was kind of good construction of a new system, or whether it was also because it only lasts for 3 months and this evanescence make it exist, and that's the beauty of it. Somehow.
Yeah, I mean there is a joke that there's only one thing worse than being co-opted by capitalism, that's not being co-opted. And actually, capitalism in many areas is not very innovative. And a lot of popular innovations are capitalized upon and get commodified. I mean, music, for example, musical traditions are a classic kind of area where that goes on. You know, if you look at some of the ways in which the sorts of experiments that went on in counter-capitalist urbanization in the 1970s and how they got co-opted into new forms of urbanization in the 1980s and 1990s, you might well say, well, actually, this was a way of drawing capitalism into a more adequate kind of way of life for, you know, in other words, it could be seen as partially progressive. But for me, that doesn't answer some of the fundamental questions I would have right now about, you know, what kind of alternatives is going to emerge out of the current crisis. I mean, let's face it, the current crisis is an urban crisis in many ways. It has its origins in housing markets and in urban development. A lot of excess capital flowed into urbanization projects which are not earning a rate of return, but which are speculative. And what that means is that, again, come back to the former question, that actually we have to really rethink urbanization in relationship to capitalist dynamics, and in the process be prepared, if necessary, to take, as it were, an anti-capitalist direction. So I'm, you know, very much more concerned with that than sort of really being concerned about, well, will this initiative here get co-opted by capital? Well, yes, the answer is probably in many instances it will. But right now, I don't think that the system, the capitalist system, is robust enough and has enough capacity to find, say, $1.5 trillion worth of new investment profitable opportunities. It doesn't happen. And it's hard to see where it's going to be. I mean, you can see some of it, still has huge possibilities in China, and it's pretty clear that the Chinese are at least, still growing at 7 or 8% per year. And there's an interesting analogy between what the Chinese are doing and what happened in this country after World War II. I talked about suburbanization, construction of the highways, this kind of thing. The Chinese national economy is not spatially integrated very well, and a lot of the infrastructural investment in China is about doing the equivalent of what the interstate highway system did in the United States in the 1960s. And if you know anything about Chinese urbanization, you'd see, well, actually, they're doing a copy in some ways of the 1960s, and it's pretty disastrous, in my view, economically and ecologically. So the Chinese have this possibility to actually do something a bit like was done in this country in the 1950s and 1960s to entrain the global economy. But again, I don't think it's strong enough to entrain the whole of the global economy in the way that U.S. suburbanization did after World War II. I mean, the U.S. dominated the global economy so thoroughly in the 1950s, 1960s, that what happened here was pretty much determinant for the rest of the world. What happens in China now is having big impacts on the rest of the world. So Australia is doing well, Chile is doing well, because they're providing all the raw materials flowing into China. So they've got that going. So there are, if you like, aspects of the capitalist dynamic which are working kind of quite well, but then aspects of the capitalist dynamic that will indeed move into co-opt, if you like, any kind of innovative action which is being set up. But I just don't see it as being strong enough to actually solve the huge kind of issue that arises in the capitalist dynamic right now. So yes, those sorts of issues, but I think that, again, this depends very much on the scale at which you think about kind of particular projects. I mean, if your idea is, well, you know, we can set up this organization, then maybe somehow or other capital will come along and buy us out and we'll all be wealthy for the next 20 years, you know. Well, yeah, some people, I'm sure, will still be able to do that, but the possibilities are going to be much more limited than they have been, say, in the 1990s. And for that reason, most of us are going to have to start to think about an alternative politics at a much broader scale and situate ourselves in relationship to what I call a sort of a co-revolutionary movement, which has to be constructed if we're going to start to really, really grapple with the question of what kind of alternative can be constructed to the capitalist dynamic right now, given the relations which have now, you know, the structures that now exist and the geography that now exists. And that's, to me, if you like, the heart of the problem.
Well, we have time for two more questions only.
How do we just get two or three questions?
Yeah, maybe we can collect your questions and then...
I wanted to ask, you mentioned that thinking of history as a terrain of struggle rather than progress, and I just wanted to ask your opinion on the role of destruction and intentionally gumming up the works in social transformation, and how that fits within all these other movements.
Thank you. I have a question about debt and the limits of debt. So right now we see at UC, the University of California has all these student occupations, and people are saying they want education, not student loans. And we see Take Back the Land saying they want housing and not mortgages. And likewise with healthcare, people are saying we want healthcare, we don't want to pay medical bills. So, and then you've talked about all of this excess capital. So where do those things fit together, and how do we think about debt right now?
Just to go back to the people with the lawnmowers for a moment. So short of making, from a top-down decision, short of making that lifestyle unfeasible, how do we include the people whose day-to-day existence relies on a capitalist structure in a movement?
Yeah, well, capitalism has always been about creative destruction. And I think when you're talking about coming up with works, you're talking about what happens when capitalism actually thrives very much on destructions. About 1 year's worth of total output in goods and services has been destroyed just over the last year through the crisis. You have huge creative destruction that occurred during the 1980s through deindustrialization. Of course, if you include World War II as an episode of creative destruction in capitalism's history, you would argue that actually capitalism survives and thrives on episodes of destruction which allow it to start again. I came across an interesting small version of that. I was in Lebanon last summer, and I asked, I said, well, what are the impacts of the crisis in Lebanon? And the answer was, we don't notice it. Why not? Because they're so busy rebuilding from the Israeli attacks that they have full employment, and they had a stimulus package, as it were, going for the last 3-4 years. Now, when the reconstruction is finished in a year or so, they'll be in considerable difficulty. But the consequence of that, you say, well, if you want to survive a capitalist crisis, then you should get the Israelis to come and bomb all of your infrastructures first. And then when the capitalist crisis comes along and you've borrowed all the money you've got, you need to reconstruct, then that's where you are, which brings me to the question of debt. You know, there's two sides to the debt problem. One is that capitalists borrow in order to invest. But the second is that people and capitalists and governments borrow in order to absorb the output. So that actually the debt economy that's particularly grown up since the 1970s has been a way of reconciling the gap between what I call wage repression on the one side, which is that actually globally the share of wages in gross domestic product or global product has been steadily falling since the 1970s. It's been steadily falling in this country, steadily falling in China, so that actually there's been wage repression, and which means that people have less and less money to spend on goods, which means there's an effective demand problem. Who's going to buy the product? And the answer to that was credit cards, and get out your credit cards and go shopping. So that actually a tripling of debt, household debt in this country since 1980 has been crucial to squaring the circle, if you like, between wage repression and increasing demand in the market. And it's not only households that are borrowing, corporations borrow and governments borrow. So the debt economy becomes very, very important in squaring the circle, if you like, between wage repression on the one hand and keeping the demand for goods in the market high on the other. And clearly there's a point at which you can't sustain that, and you know, that's around when we hit it last summer, a couple of summers ago. So this is a big issue. So that's where the debt economy starts to become very, very significant. And the collapse of the debt economy then becomes, you know, well, you can see what's happening right now, is this scramble to try to actually reconstruct the debt economy. And the big scramble is, well, households aren't borrowing as much as they were, they're actually saving a bit more than they used to, what are we going to do? So government borrows more. Corporations aren't borrowing, although actually it's not a bad idea to borrow right now because interest rates are very low, so there is some borrowing going on there. So the debt economy is really crucial, but actually the debt economy is also about destruction. I mean, what we've seen is the destruction of asset values. I mean, I've kind of mentioned in the African-American population that the loss of asset values, even before the subprime crisis hit, was huge. And this is an accumulation by dispossession, as I call it, you know, and it's actually engineered through the debt economy. I mean, the debt economy is fundamental to the transformation of family farms into agribusiness. It's been fundamental to, so the debt economy becomes a vehicle by which you sustain huge concentrations of wealth at one end of the scale and actually progressively impoverish larger and larger populations at the other end of the scale, which is why I'm extremely skeptical about notions of, for instance, microfinance and microcredit and all the rest of it, because a lot of that is precisely about sucking wealth out of low-income populations. I mean, the rate of interest on microfinance is around 18 to 25%, if you're lucky. In many instances, it's as high as 40%. And this is a sucking of wealth out of low-income populations. And again, this is something that ought not to be tolerated, and again, it's something that's likely to lead to very destructive kinds of circumstances. Which brings me back to the last question. You know, there's going to be a battle over who's going to be on your side. And I think that, you know, my good friend Peter Marcuse likes to talk about an alliance between the discontented and alienated on the one hand and the dispossessed and the deprived on the other. And since I belong to the first group, which is the alienated and discontented, I can't claim I'm really deprived and dispossessed at all. But there has to be an alliance of some kind. Now, there are indeed many people who are very happy with their lives and their all knowers and all the rest of it, but then there are some people who are not. And so this then arises, it comes to the question of how to spread the virus of discontent. And actually the educational system has a lot to do with this. And one of the big problems we have in academia is we don't have enough radicals around in academia to do this right now. Academia has been totally colonized by the neoliberal ethic. It's been totally colonized by sort of corporatist logic. And therefore it's very, very difficult for a radical voice to really have much heft inside of academia. So there are all sorts of issues within the educational system. We all have to fight our battles where we find them. Question was raised earlier about, you know, well, what do I think about how to organize, you know, and, well, the one place where I do try to organize inside of academia. And it's a huge struggle, I can tell you. I mean, to try to keep spaces open inside of academia where radical work can go on and free thought can go on is actually a real big difficulty right now. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to keep those spaces open. And but then that comes in the question of, can we even get into, for instance, the mass media? Well, I finally got off the big battle. I finally got on Amy Goodman. That's about as far as I can get, you know. I've lost count of them. I gave up writing op-eds for the New York Times. I never published anything, you know. So you know that actually we're faced with these difficulties. But this is, again, a very interesting moment because, as I see it, historically, if we can use any historical parallels, it would be to say, look, there's a legitimation crisis at the moment right now. I mean, it's pretty clear as to who's benefiting from all of the bailouts and all the rest of it. The traditional legitimation that this is just the market and blah, blah, blah doesn't work. So the only way in which you can actually create a legitimation for it right now is to kind of say, well, actually, we believe in class power. And we believe in upper class power, the perpetuation of upper class power. Now, legitimation crises have a different rhythm than financial crises. And my guess is that in exactly the same way that the stock exchange crash occurred in 1929, but it was only about 1922 or 1932 or 33 that you start to really find the social movements out there articulating them as a legitimation crisis, big time. The Communist Party is starting to get organized and everything else, and the bourgeoisie realizes it has to do something about that. And therefore you get big strikes which occur in the 1937-38. In other words, my guess is at this moment we're beginning to move into the stage where the legitimation of the system is looking very shaky. It's much easier now to make the point that actually you look at this class privilege, and it's very hard for anybody to deny the class privilege that exists and what its importance is. And so there is, if you like, a legitimation question which is emerging. And that's one of the things which, you know, on the academic side, we can do something to try to exploit. But it also needs a lot of popular support. It needs to be popularized somehow. And again, the social movements, to the degree that they can actually sort of start to get to people, then the legitimation crisis builds. I mean, listen to the rhetoric of take back the land or whatever, and clearly it's delegitimizing what's been going on. And to the degree that people listen to it or hear it or see it makes common sense, then it seems to me the virus of discontent is likely to grow amongst both those who are just merely discontented and alienated, as well as amongst those who are dispossessed and deprived. So again, there's an inflection moment right now. We're at that kind of a phase, which is why it's so interesting. You know, just to sort of live it through it, to see that very little organization last summer, but now it's beginning to come into being, and I think that by next summer there's likely to be much more social action around, and much more questioning of the legitimacy of the system. And to the degree that builds, as it did in the 1930s, there can start to be real social movements who will move to big time arguing for big time social change, and whether the system can accommodate it, like got accommodated in the late 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, whether the system can do that or not is a big open question. But we have to go for the legitimation of the system right now, as well as actually pointing to the absolute appalling inequalities under which people live.